Hello and welcome to the JD Sports Show brought to you by Based in Fact. I'm your host, Jarrett Jennings. Football is finally back, but the Jacksonville Jaguars are already off to a sour note. Marquise Lee was injured in the team's third preseason game after taking a big hit in the first quarter by Falcons safety Monte Casey. Lee was the team's receptions leader last year with 56. He posted 702 yards and 3 touchdowns. So that's a big hole to fill for the Jaguars. So this is going to be a difficult transition for a team that was almost in the Super Bowl last year.
Yeah, it will be a difficult transition. There's going to be a period of adjustment, meaning they will now have this opportunity to look at some of the other receivers they have on the roster. They acquired DJ Chark, a 6'4 receiver out of Louisiana State University, the notorious receiving factory. He's likely going to be a downhill kind of threat, a deep threat that they can use to take advantage of their quarterback, Blake Bortles, has a very huge arm and throwing capacity. In addition to helping out with that aspect of the passing game, they've also acquired Dante Moncrief, a veteran wide receiver, another big-bodied guy around 6'2", 6'3", who also can be advantageous in that same role. And, of course, returning, we have players such as D.D. Westbrook, who mostly made his living on kick returns last year. High draft pick out of Oklahoma could possibly look to contribute more with Marquise Lee out.
Keelan Cole looked like a star in the making last year, so they're going to have to find another number two to pair with him, and it might be fun for the Jaguars to see how Dante Moncrief works out as a number two receiver, or even DJ Chark, the rookie. And Rashad Green out of FSU, right. He's had a couple of years on the roster now, so Marquise Lee's injury could potentially open the door for these guys to have bigger roles this season. You also have a guy in Jadon Mickens, who he's mostly a kick returner, but could be a real good slot guy for them if he develops this year. He's a young player that they really liked last year and brought him back to camp this year. So it'll be interesting to see how the Jaguars adjust to losing their top pass catcher from last season.
Correct. And the possibilities they have to exploit wide receiver is one of the few silver linings to take out of the situation. The other one I want to point out is the lack of malice behind the hit that ended up making Marquise Lee lose this amount of time in his offense. It seemed the safety from the Falcons wasn't looking to inflict that kind of damage. He did offer a very heartfelt apology, correct?
Yes, Monte Casey tweeted an apology to Lee after the game, saying that he never goes out to hurt players and that he had Lee in his prayers. Moving on from some bad news to some good news, Adrian Peterson has found another job in the NFL. He's now the starting running back for the Washington Redskins. This is an interesting move for a team in transition. They just added Alex Smith to replace Kirk Cousins, who is going to be playing in Minnesota this season. This is an interesting move. What do you think of it?
Well, life certainly comes at you fast when you're Adrian Peterson and the teams that acquire him. He garnered very low interest in free agency given his history, the fact that he is a running back over 30 that runs with a punishing running style, that they typically don't have a very long shelf life, but the DC football team was not expecting to have him on their roster this year, and neither was Arizona last year when he joined them. Something that was dropped in their lap very abruptly after it hadn't worked out so well in New Orleans. But this experiment seems to be a very solid acquisition. Look for great things to come from Adrian Peterson, as, again, he seemed to quiet his doubters last season in his very short stint in Arizona. So how do we get to this point? How do we get Adrian Peterson on this DC roster? What happened?
Well, it's always nice to see something positive come out of something negative. The negative was that Darius Geis, the running back out of LSU that the Redskins took in the second round of the draft this year, tore his ACL, and he'll miss the entire season. The team also has Chris Thompson coming off an injury last season, and with the injury histories of Robert Kelly and Samaje Perine, there was too much uncertainty in the Washington backfield for them not to make this move. So this is going to be a solid move. I can definitely see Adrian Peterson making his way back possibly to the Pro Bowl this year. He took 11 carries for 56 yards in his first preseason action with Alex Smith under center. I really like Washington's shot this year at the playoffs. I think they've got a better quarterback this year in Alex Smith than they had in Kirk Cousins. Josh Doctson, Jamison Crowder are returning, and they acquired Paul Richardson from the Seattle Seahawks. So this is a good team with a lot of talent, a lot of upside. They also have Brian Quick from the Rams. This team could potentially be a surprise in the league this year as far as how deep they go.
Yes, I agree. The receiving core you mentioned is very talented. They have the potential to do great things. Obviously, with Darius Geis going down, you had a situation where things looked a bit uncertain. Here we are, we have this well-rounded offense that seemed to be in jeopardy, but plugging in Adrian Peterson to go with the new addition of Alex Smith at quarterback as your signal caller works out at this point in Adrian Peterson's career. Look for him to be most effective in the first two downs. So he complements what they have going on very well.
Yeah, Chris Thompson's going to be the guy on third down, possibly second down. He's a good pass catcher out of the backfield. Right. He's a speedster, although we still have to see how he looks coming back from that injury, how he looks especially early in the season. But I expect to see him blazing down the field like he did last year. Adrian Peterson in 2017, 6 games, 6 starts for the Cardinals, 448 yards and 2 touchdowns. We'll see if he can replicate that possibly further into the season this year. He's had his own injury history, but it looks like he could potentially have enough track left on the tires to bring this Washington team together.
Agreed. Folks, don't be shocked to see the Redskins in the playoffs. It could very well happen. The division is pretty tough, but anything can happen when you have Adrian Peterson on your team.
Transitioning from an old guy who's found a new home to an old guy who's called it quits, Eric Decker has officially retired from the NFL after a short stint with the New England Patriots. I did not see him panning out for the Patriots. You could definitely tell the production was waning on him, especially in these last few seasons. How about you?
This is just a situation of beggars can't be choosers. Yes, New England was in a tough spot with their receiving core. Obviously, we have Edelman and Gronk returning. However, Edelman will have to wait until week 5 to make his return. Danny Amendola was traded to the Dolphins after being the number one target for Tom Brady in the past postseason. In addition to that, Brandon Cooks, who was a very solid contributor and a big playmaker in the receiving game, has been jettisoned to Los Angeles in exchange for a first-round pick. The receiving core looked worse for wear, and this is before I even mention Kenny Britt being cut and Jordan Matthews also failing to secure a roster spot. A lot of things happened that made Eric Decker the ideal receiver to bring in, but as you stated, his production had been waning. The writing was on the walls, and just to try to learn that playbook in such a short amount of time to be ready for the season was a high expectation for him at this point in his career. So him going to retirement is good for him, but not good for New England.
So who steps up for the Patriots this season?
Cordarrelle Patterson is an interesting acquisition. He looked like a long shot to see on his roster when he was first acquired, but he very likely will be a guy who will be on this roster and could actually play a very big role. He will play the role as a deep threat after, to be honest, moonlighting as a wide receiver. He was typically a kick returner, punt returner in his days in Oakland and Minnesota. He is now at a point where he's going to have to play some wideout in the meantime. There's a possibility he can be the guy that stretches the field, makes some space for Gronk underneath, and give them time to stall until Julian Edelman comes back and they can run the offense they're used to running.
He's got 11 catches in the preseason, which is good for second. He's also got 126 yards and a touchdown and one catch for 20-plus. I expect to see a lot more of those 20-plus yard catches this year out of him. As for Eric Decker, his last 1,000-yard season came in 2015, and he was injured in 2016. He only played 3 games. And then he went to the Titans in 2017, where he posted 563 yards, which surprised me because he was not very productive with the Titans. You didn't hear his name called a whole lot. I'm surprised he garnered that many yards on 54 receptions.
Adam Pac-Man Jones, a former first-round pick, has been acquired by the Denver Broncos after spending the last 5 or 6 seasons in Cincinnati. Denver had the need. Whether or not Pac-Man Jones makes the roster in the end, they do need somebody for that cornerback position. They have Chris Harris Jr. returning, who's obviously going to be somebody who's going to be a mainstay in that defense. However, they lost Aqib Talib. He has also been jettisoned to Los Angeles. Adam Pac-Man Jones will be looking to at least take up a roster spot in that defensive backfield. His production hasn't exactly turned a lot of heads, but he has been in the league a lot longer than I expect him to be personally. How do you feel about Adam Jones being acquired by the Denver Broncos?
I think it's a good pickup for the Broncos. I think losing Aqib Talib loses a lot of production out of the defensive backfield. Pac-Man has 16 career interceptions. I think this is a good pickup for them. He joins Darian Stewart and Bradley Roby and Chris Harris in the Broncos secondary. I really think he's going to be productive for the team, and I could see him sticking on this roster.
Yeah, it should definitely be interesting to see what happens in that Denver defense. Their defense is obviously the least of their problems, but again, it is just amazing to see a guy like Pac-Man Jones maintain his position in the league for over a decade now.
And even though the Pac-Man aspect of his game is gone, he could definitely add value to the Broncos secondary.
For sure. He's lost a step, but he can definitely contribute in more ways, and it's going to be interesting to see what he does and how he does that.
And even with the Broncos, offense is changing so rapidly with Case Keenum at quarterback, Chad Kelly is stepping up. There's potential here for Vance Joseph's Denver Broncos to make some noise in the league. They're kind of an under-the-radar team. Nobody really expects them to be back in the playoffs. I think they're looking more at the Raiders, the Chiefs, to win that division. LA
right.
is always a
force of habit.
Yes, LA is always in the conversation for the playoffs, potentially the Super Bowl. This could be Philip Rivers' year, though we've been saying that for the last 10 years. but this will be an interesting Broncos franchise, I think. Pairing Von Miller and Bradley Chubb, and now you got Adam Pac-Man Jones in the defensive backfield. That takes us now to baseball.
We're coming to the end of the season in baseball.
The hunt for October
has begun. It is underway. We are pretty much in September right now. As things currently stand out, we're going to start with the West Division. So we have the Diamondbacks leading the National League West by 0.5 game over the Colorado Rockies. In turn, the Dodgers are just 2.5 games behind the Colorado Rockies. This is going to be one of those tight division races. The Dodgers did what they could to try to bridge the gap a little bit by acquiring Manny Machado to play in their infield. He's a kid, a solid fielder, highly a native. Definitely the big acquisition during the summer. A lot of people thought he'd be going to New York. Even he wasn't certain at one point in time with the infamous Snapchat video that got out. Here we are. He is in the middle of a National League West playoff race with his team just 2.5 games behind second place. What's your take on this?
This is very surprising looking at the playoff standings currently and seeing the Dodgers 2.5 games out of the wild card spot, that's amazing to me because they're coming off a World Series run
where they
fell to the Houston Astros, but they're 2.5 games out of the playoffs entirely, and they've been a good team. They've won 70 games, only 61 losses. This is a weird season for records in relation to the playoffs because so many teams have solid records.
Yeah, and they might miss those playoffs, as you mentioned. And, you know, again, the Dodgers were the team. They took the Astros to 7 games in a thrilling World Series.
One of the best I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. Extra innings, you know, countless amount of times. A lot of people were late for work the next day. But here we are. The Dodgers are a team that historically has a lot of big names on it. They do currently. Their production hasn't quite matched it yet, but there's still plenty of time for them to get back to that final dance in October. And speaking of the Dodgers, the opponent they had in the World Series we just mentioned, the Astros, are in the lead of the AL West. They have a 1-game lead, but if the order holds, going through to September, we could very well see the Astros make another run at the World Series. We haven't had a repeat champion in a long time. The Astros have a good shot at getting that done, as good as anyone has had in a while.
They're going to have a tough time outplaying the Athletics here, though, towards the end.
They're on their heels.
The Athletics and Astros are both 7-3 in their last 10 games, and the Athletics are only 1.5 games out of the conversation with the Astros at 79-52.
That they are. That they are. And again, we're having a funny year with these records because you'd think close to 80 wins before August is over. You would think that you'd at least have the division well in hand, but here they are. They're 1.5 games out. And then on their heels is the Mariners. Granted, this is a 5.5 game gap, but the Mariners have an offense that's more than capable of bridging that gap, putting up the runs to make that lead a lot smaller. The problem with the Mariners is obviously their starting pitching. The ERA is sky high with everybody. I don't think anyone has an ERA underneath 3.5 in that rotation. However, the bullpen has been solid. Their closer is already at 50 saves. If the Mariners can just put together their bats, the bats of Cano if he plays some more games, Nelson Cruz if he comes to life, Kyle Seager can definitely bomb. Segura is definitely another guy would pop in his bat. We can have another tight 3-team race here in about a couple of weeks in the AL West. So no matter where you are in the West, American League or National League, it is getting hot. Where it is not getting hot is the Central. We will start with the American League Central. The Indians have a definitive stranglehold on that division. Considering that there is 1.5 months left, the Indians have a 13-game lead and are likely to be going into the playoffs.
Yeah, it doesn't look like the Twins are going to do much to catch them, 4-6 in their last 10. Cleveland's not been playing excellent baseball as of late, 5-5 in their last 10, but they've definitely got themselves a nice pad of 13 games that is going to be close to, if not impossible, for the Twins to overcome. The Indians are a good team. They've been there before, and they're likely to compete again here at the end. We could see them go back to the World Series?
We can. It's a very long shot. They're not the strongest team in the American League, but they do have the whole division. And again, we're coming back to the theme here that's going to be recurring in this baseball chat. It's a funny year for records because the Indians have 74 wins, and that wouldn't even be good for third place in the AL West. But it's good enough to give them a substantial lead in their AL Central division. As you mentioned, they haven't been putting up the most sterling performance in the last 10 games. The hottest team, however, in that division has been the White Sox. They've been 7-3, but at this point in the season, 28 games below 500, it is highly unlikely that they have enough heat to catch Cleveland.
And it's kind of funny because the Tigers, who are out without Miguel Cabrera and Justin Verlander, who they lost last season, traded to the Houston Astros, they're 53-78, and they're in third place in the AL Central ahead of the White Sox, who are always in the conversation, but the Tigers have a two-game lead on them.
Yeah, they do. As you alluded to before, the Tigers are exceeding the low expectations they had for this season, being that they lost their franchise cornerstones, one, Miguel Cabrera to injury, and two, Justin Verlander to being traded to a contender. I was not really expecting them to do this well. If you had told me before the season started the Tigers, you know, would eclipse 44 wins, I'm pretty sure that would have earned you a drug test at your place of employment. But here we are. They've have 50 wins, and there's more than a month of baseball left. So they've definitely exceeded expectations. Granted, they're still quite a bit below 500, but again,
trending in the right direction.
Hats off to the Tigers for trending in the right direction and staying somewhat afloat. Moving on to the National League Central. Cubs, first place. They're up by 4 games. To be honest, I don't quite see this changing much.
It's an interesting fight because the Cardinals and Cubs are both 7-3 in their last 10 games. I know we keep going back to this, but that the last 10 games and leading up to the playoffs, these 10 game stretches are very important record-wise because the Cubs, Cardinals, and Brewers are all within 5 games of that spot.
That they are. And how good a team is playing in the last 10 games is a good indicator of where their morale is at. Remember, half the battle is mental. They're getting results on the field, and when they're streaking and trending in the right direction, it does a lot for their psyche. And again, this is a close race. Cubs got it first, Cardinals back by 4, and then the Brewers are back by half a game after them. But they're all 70-plus win teams. This could be tight, but my, you know, humble prediction is just I think the Cubs are going to find a way to secure the bag and clinch this pennant.
You can never count out the Pirates either, only 13 games back, but they're not doing very well as of late. The Reds stuck in the basement as per the huge.
Right, as per the huge. Speaking as per the huge, when I was a kid, the Braves were usually the team that was in first place in the National League East Division, which frustrated me as a person who lives in South Florida and likes the Marlins playing baseball. As per the huge, the Braves found themselves again in first place in this division following a rebuild that took a lot shorter than projected. This was a very quick turnaround. They were not a team that was going to be a contender just thinking about 3 years ago. But this Ronald Acuna kid has really been a key contributor in their success, no?
Very much so. He's hitting .288 this year. He's got 87 hits, 21 home runs, and 45 RBIs. Even the recent dust-ups with the Marlins have shown what a truly great hitter and great player this guy is. Teams are trying to take him out of the game. Whenever a team's trying to take you out of the game, you know you must be doing something right.
Absolutely. You'd rather a team try to take a player out the honest way by striking him out or just giving him the Bonds treatment and walking him intentionally. But, you know, desperation is spawned from greatness, and this kid happens to be great. As you mentioned, 21 home runs, 45 RBIs, lets you know that if he was able to get to bat with runners in scoring position, there could be fireworks.
And, you know, speaking of the Marlins, stuck in the basement once again of the NL East, it looks like they're not going anywhere this season, but could they be going somewhere in the future?
My humble prediction is, yeah, it's definitely within the realm of possibilities. The Marlins, like the Tigers, are another team that you set a very low bar for when the season started. Of course, we had the infamous fire sale. Their entire outfield is gone. Stanton to the Yankees, Ozuna to the Cardinals, Yelich to the Brewers. Their exciting, flashy second baseman is gone. They've done a lot to strip this team of very valuable contributors and fan favorites. But it does seem like they're trying to do this rebuild the right way, and as a consolation prize, they have 53 wins to this point in the season, which is a lot better than we all thought they'd have, right?
Jeff Loria and David Sampson gave this franchise absolutely no reason to trust the new ownership, but Derek Jeter might be doing this the right way. It remains to be seen, but I had them winning 44 games this season at most.
Right.
They've won 53. They're not the worst team in the major leagues.
Shockingly.
But they're far from the best. The only thing that really bothers me about the Marlins at this point is that they're five wins back from the New York Mets, who are 58-72 and a complete train wreck of a franchise.
Yes, talk about a franchise that really is struggling to grasp its sense of direction. We have the New York Mets, who, despite all their trouble, still managed to avoid the National League East basement. Five games above the Marlins, as you alluded to. That's definitely not going to change. And the biggest shock we can say of all is the Nationals. Not only are they not in first, but they are out of first place by quite a wide margin. We haven't seen the Nationals 8.5 games back behind first in a very long time. It's the team that went to the playoffs last year. What are your thoughts on that and the Bryce Harper effect?
He's flashy. He's flamboyant. He's very marketable.
Yes,
but
is
he one of the best players in the league? Is he going to be worth the $400+ million contract that he wants next year? I don't see him as the same superstar or in the same breath as Mike Trout, as he's been associated with for the majority of his career.
It seemed like Mike Trout was just a natural right away. Flashed a lot of potential. Running, fielding, great at the plate, lots of plate vision and patience. And we were just looking for Bryce Harper to develop those tools. And again, the potential is still there. He's still a young guy, but he just hasn't quite closed the gap between him and Mike Trout. Mike Trout's obviously widely acclaimed as the best player in baseball today, and Bryce Harper is, realistically speaking, just not at that level yet.
But baseball is a team sport, and the Angels are also stuck at 63-68, 17.5 games back in the AL West. Mike Trout is a better baseball player than Bryce Harper.
Right.
But neither of these teams is going anywhere.
That appears to be correct. It does look like Mike Trout, however, will likely be playing for a long time in an Angels uniform, whereas Bryce Harper, as you alluded to, wants a big contract, might not get it in D.C., could possibly get it in New York as a Yankee. The idea has been kicked around, and speaking of the Yankees, we have the AL East standings. We've said several times that this has been an odd year for team records. The Yankees have the second best record in all of baseball. Unfortunately, it's also the second best in all of the AL East. They are behind the Boston Red Sox by 6.5 games. It looks like we have another Yankees-Red Sox showdown, just like old times.
And the Yankees 7-3 in their last 10 to Boston's 4-6. There's potential here for the Yankees to catch the Red Sox, but as of right now, the Yankees are stuck in the wild card spot.
If there is one threat to the Astros representing the American League in the World Series, it is the Boston Red Sox, without a shadow of a doubt. They have been the best team. They have been the most well-rounded. From almost day one, they've had a stranglehold on baseball, their division. They've made fireworks happen, and it looks like they're going to have a showdown with the Yankees at some point in the playoffs. It should be interesting if the Yankees clinch the wild card. And again, we can see these two young teams going at it for all the marbles.
Another team that's red hot right now, but very far out of first place, are the Tampa Bay Rays. They're 8-2 in their last 10. The hottest team, the hottest record.
Yes.
But at 70-61, it just doesn't look like they're going to be able to catch either the Yankees nor the Red Sox. We'll see down the stretch if they can make some noise, possibly carry some momentum in the next season. And then we have the Orioles, who are entering a transitional period. And at 37-93, it's obvious that the first team out of the playoff conversation has the furthest to go.
52 games back behind first place is not a position that inspires a lot of confidence for the current season or any season going forward, for that matter. And this is where we have the Orioles. This is a year that on paper wasn't expected to be so unfavorable for them. Again, they aren't a team that had a fire sale, but yet they are behind the team that had the fire sale in terms of record.
And they traded some key pieces of their team away. They did.
If there is one thing to keep your head up about, is the prospects you've gotten in return for some of your superstars that you've lost in the last couple of years. So it's definitely interesting to see if they can make that dramatic jump to the top of the division like the Braves had out of nothing.
And be sure to check out Based in Fact to really get an idea of what the Orioles got back for the players that they traded.
Absolutely.
Now we're transitioning into the start of the college football season.
Week zero.
Hawaii 43, Colorado State 34. It was an exciting game with a lot of scoring. Cole McDonald, Hawaii's quarterback, was 26 of 37 for 418 yards and 3 touchdowns through the air. But more impressive, he had 13 carries for 96 yards and 2 touchdowns on the ground.
Fun to see the entire game. It was an absolute quarterback shootout. As you mentioned, Cole McDonald had a fantastic game on the ground and through the air. And not to be entirely outdone, Mr. KJ Carter-Samuels, also electric, under center.
50 attempts.
Yeah, but over 500 yards to show for it and 5 touchdowns. He had an interception, but it just comes with the territory. He kept his team in it. His wideouts kept the team in it. Each receiver eclipsed the 150-yard mark. The top two guys, anyway, they both had 2 touchdowns to show for their efforts.
Preston Williams and Olabisi Johnson.
The efficiency on Mr. Olabisi Johnson, 6 catches for over 150 yards, 26 yards a clip. Outstanding. This is exactly the kind of game that you want to think of to open a season. And speaking of Hawaii,
we segue into the national champions of 2017, the UCF Knights. Athletic director Danny White, who has adjusted to Scott Frost's departure for Nebraska and hiring Josh Heupel. Heupel has a lot to work with offensively. He is actually not only the head coach, but it appears like he'll serve as the offensive coordinator as well. He brought in Randy Shannon to man the defense. Randy Shannon is very well known in South Florida and the state of Florida as the head coach of the Hurricanes briefly the interim head coach at UF.
To be quite honest, I had my doubts. They definitely had an impressive season. Last season, I did think that the loss of talent on the field on, both sides of the ball to the NFL draft or to graduation would be a lot to overcome. However, it does seem that they have acquired a capable coaching staff that could get that done. As we know, Randy Shannon wasn't quite the answer at the helm at the University of Miami as the Hurricanes head coach, but he is a defensive specialist. And he is brought in to offset the loss, potentially, of their best playmaker on defense last year in Shaquem Griffin. Likewise, you know, Josh Heupel will be manning the offense, as you stated, have a big role in that. He was that kind of role in Missouri. He was also an offensive specialist in his days as a coach on the Sooner staff, where they had Sam Bradford, who did go number one overall in the draft, another talented quarterback in NCAA. He has another one to work with in Mackenzie Milton, so there's a lot of potential to see what they can do in Mackenzie's final years of eligibility here.
And, you know, Scott Frost brought Eric Shenander and Troy Walters with him to Nebraska. Most of the UCF coaching staff followed Frost to Nebraska. Scott Frost also took some recruits with him, like Traquan Smith's brother. It's difficult to see a guy like Frost leave. Heupel's got a lot of talent returning to this roster. Adrian Killens, Mackenzie Milton, Dredrick Snelson should lead the offense. It's going to be a difficult road for a team coming off such an exceptional season. Even one loss, it'll feel like they didn't accomplish what they were searching for this year. They've got a couple tough tasks in FAU and UNC, but they've got returning players on the defense and Joey Connors, Pat Jasinski, and Tristan Hill. Wyatt Miller's coming back for another season on the offensive line, and they'll get Parker Boudreaux, a Notre Dame transfer. This is going to be a very good team again, and I really expect them to have another solid season. The American Athletic Conference is hungry and talented, and I don't think enough people see that.
No doubt. No disrespect to UConn, but it does look like you might be slightly outmatched in this civil conflict game.
They're going to be just as hungry, if not hungrier, to beat UCF out of the gate.
Right. There's nothing like taking it to a team that hadn't lost a game last year as your audition, as your welcoming to the new world, and the University of Connecticut definitely is looking to get that done. Speaking of the University of Connecticut, Breonna Stewart, former UConn Husky star, has been named the WNBA MVP. Breonna has been an integral role in leading her team to the top of the West in the WNBA. She put up really great numbers. She averaged almost 22 points per game. She had 21.8. She registered 8.4 rebounds, 1.4 blocks, 1.4 steals, and 2.5 assists. Definitely an all-around player. Doesn't take any aspect of the game off. Terrific ball handler for her size and her position. Due to, you know, her conditioning herself to dribble a basketball around her neighborhood as a kid in the suburbs of New York. So, again, congratulations to her. She and her team, Seattle Storm, are coming off of playoff victory against the Phoenix Mercury, led by Deanna Taurasi, to take a 1-0 series lead.
Former first overall pick and only 24 and already the MVP. She's becoming a face of the sport.
WNBA has a history of having their own star power that rivals that of the NBA. We all know legends such as Lisa Leslie, you know, the great Cheryl Miller, who never played in the WNBA but still made a great impact on the women's game. Tina Thompson, players like Cheryl Swoops. We had that generation in the early to mid-2000s that consisted of Candace Parker and Sylvia Fowles and Maya Moore. And, you know, even before them, we had Deanna Taurasi, Lindsey Whalen, who just recently retired, played her last game. And then, of course, we have this new generation, the Asia Wilsonses, the Liz Cambridge. A lot of great talent in the WNBA. And Breonna Stewart looks to be the face of that new generation, that new bridge to talent.
That's it for us tonight. Thank you very much for listening. This has been the JD Sports Show. We'll talk to you later.